From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. New York City is always changing, but it's not just disappearing landmarks and new buildings. It's also a shifting Latino identity.
You walk a few blocks away from here and you don't have too many Latinos. And so this is a symbol of Latinos still being alive in New York City and in East Harlem, of course.
How a Puerto Rican activist group, the Young Lords, is still alive in Spanish Harlem, and Mexicanos in New York barrios everywhere.
The strangest thing about this restaurant is that there is a deer head on the wall.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we look at Nuestro Nueva York. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we're having a little bit of a hometown celebration, talking about Nuestro Nueva York, the city where we live and where we produce Latino USA. Now, in case you hadn't heard, the city recently went through a major shift in leadership, electing its first Democratic mayor in 20 years. And that has meant more Latinos and Latinas in positions of real power. One of those is Melissa Mark Viverito, who is now the speaker for the New York City Council, one of the most powerful political roles in the Big Apple. Madam Speaker, Melissa Mark Viverito is here with us in our studios in Harlem. Welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria. It's a pleasure to be here.
Full disclosure, you and I went to college together. We actually worked in radio together. And you made a decision somewhere along the line that you wanted to not focus on journalism, but to focus on politics. Did you ever imagine that you would be the speaker for the New York City Council?
Well, I never imagined myself to be in politics first and foremost. I think the seeds were planted, obviously, in my upbringing, having a mother who had been active, who was a feminist, who took me to rallies growing up in Puerto Rico, and my father being a very socially conscious doctor who used to provide care to people whether or not they could pay. You know, it kind of germinated that idea of, like, giving back and activism and involvement. And it really didn't come to play until I came to New York and went to college, really coming into an environment where you started to see and experience some level of prejudice, discrimination, of being seen as other. So that just kind of really got me to be an activist. And graduating college, became very involved in the nonprofit sector, working for the community, and being engaged at a local level in my community board. And so all of that kind of started really propelling me in a direction of being more engaged and involved. And I got recruited, so to speak. Some community people that became my mentors kind of said, you know, you really should consider running for office. We could really use some leadership.
And didn't you think, I mean, or was one of your reactions like, are you kidding me? Get involved in New York City politics?
Right. I mean, when you're an activist, you're on the outside rattling the cage, right? And trying to tell electives that they're not doing enough. So it obviously switched the dynamic for me. And I considered it and I decided to do it. And I did win, obviously. And so I just, grew into this position and just using the opportunity to have being in an elected position to really amplify the voice of a community that has historically been disenfranchised, been left out of decision making, and really started to really push policies for more equality, inclusion, and not being afraid to really stick to your principles and speak out. And it was a hard road. It was not an easy road. Now we are in a position where we have a mayor, Democratic mayor for the first time in 20 years, a progressive mayor, and now a progressive council that really wants to work on policies that are going to have an impact and demonstrate that an inclusive public policy is not one that is ineffective.
So how do you think about progressive politics, Latino politics, as having some kind of a nexus or intersection, at least in New York City?
No, definitely. I mean, when I talk about what I truly believe in, you know, when you talk about equality, when you talk about social justice, when you talk about giving everybody a chance to succeed, then that affects Latinos, that affects African-Americans, that affects Asian-Americans. But the reality is that New York City, because of its sheer size and because we are so diverse, right, we are a majority minority. And I don't like to use the word, but just in quotes so people can understand, city. And so to have to be able to enact these policies and show that they can succeed and be effective in New York City, as large as we are, can inspire, right, and really can nurture that progressive movement in other parts of the country. That's what we want to show. We want to showcase what we can do here when we talk about paid sick leave, when we talk about being inclusive of our immigrant communities and providing services and being, you know, somewhat of a sanctuary city. And I think that can definitely serve as an inspiration to other areas in this country.
So from the time when you were here, when you and I first got to New York to now, how do you think that New York, how do you think that the presence, the growing diversity of Latinos in the city, how has it changed or impacted the character of the city?
Well, the first thing you have to see is the changes that we're seeing in terms of leadership positions. And the fact that I'm the first Latina, the first Puerto Rican to hold any sort of office that has citywide influence.
Which is a lot of people would just think, wait a second, are you saying that in New York City you are now the first Latino, Latina to have held a major position of influence in city government?
Yes. And it's a humbling, obviously, a humbling situation to be in. And I know that there's a lot of expectation. But those breaking those barriers are really incredibly important. You know, sometimes people want to say, oh, you know, we're colorblind or we should be colorblind. I don't believe that because we bring different perspectives. I think the whole conversation and debate that emerged when Sonia Sotomayor was, you know, a candidate for the Supreme Court is like, you know, she lived some experiences. As a Latina woman, as a Puerto Rican woman, that helped really provide insight into an important function. And that can be lost. We need and to really look for those experiences that sometimes people from other backgrounds will never have. So to have, you know, a Bill de Blasio who has progressive ideals, but then to have a Letitia James, the first African-American woman in a citywide position, to have Melissa Mark Viverito now, the first Latina to be in a position of citywide influence. I mean, it is a significant shift for this city. And I think that it's really important if we want government to be of the people, it has to be inclusive of the people.
You have really come out very clearly about New York City being a haven for child refugees from Central America. Have you been effective? What, in fact, is the city doing in terms of the conversation about becoming a haven for these children?
So in terms of whether it's the housing, you know, of children and their families, we know that I think in New York we have about 3,000 children that have come because we are an immigrant city. So a lot of these children may have relatives, extended family already here. So my understanding based on the numbers is about 3,000 children. But now we know that as of today, there's the expedited cases, right, for deportations. And these children do not have legal representation. So I know that our public advocate yesterday, you know, did a press conference calling for people to provide pro bono legal services. That's one thing we immediately need to do. Also, how can we, and I know some nonprofits are having conversations with the feds about whether or not they can receive some level of federal funding to house children. So it's a bit in flux because it is such a crisis and it's happening so quickly. Sometimes the policies aren't keeping up.
Another place where you have become front and center is the conversation about New York City working to implement a municipal ID program.
Yes.
Municipal ID, what is that? It's basically a city ID for anyone, and it can really help undocumented people, clearly, but it could also help others. So where do things stand in terms of New York City, in effect, becoming the largest city to ever implement a municipal ID program?
Definitely was a priority for us, me now as speaker, and then it was great to hear the mayor also say that he believed in it. So we were able to expedite it to that extent. We had the support internally in the council, and we made it happen. It's already law. The mayor signed it. Now it's a matter of implementation. So between us and as a council and the city agencies that have to put this in place, we want to make it sure that we are ready to roll it out in January of 2015. And as you said, this is a municipal ID for every New Yorker, obviously the press and some critics are focusing on the undocumented, you know, the benefit to the undocumented community. This is about being able to avail yourself to city services. And this is a way of validating people that live here, that are contributing here, that are already part of the fabric of our city and our communities. And so for a senior who may have difficulty accessing a state ID, they now can have a city ID, which may give them discounts to services, can help them open up a bank account, et cetera. For the transgender member of our community who can self-identify on the card when you can't do that on state IDs. And then for the undocumented, that it's a way of, again, reinforcing that they are here, they are paying taxes. And so it's a way of them being coming out of the shadows and feeling comfortable that they can go to a police officer if they need assistance personally. For instance, a domestic violence victim, or if they've been a witness to a crime, and being able to show an ID and not be afraid to approach any sort of city official. And again, as I said at the beginning, we are a city that will never ask for anyone's documents.
Right, and that that's been the critique, right?
Yes.
The critique is like, oh my God, now the city is going to have access to all of these people's information, predominantly the undocumented, and there's concern that then it could be handed over in some way, shape, or form to law enforcement that then leads to a possible deportation, et cetera. Why not go ahead and make this ID card a smart card that actually is tied to banking and access for the unbanked? How do you deal with those criticisms?
We are very mindful that the information is not to be shared, and we have a commitment that that's the case, and we're going to put certain measures in place. The NYPD has signed on, meaning that they will accept this ID as a formal format ID, and that's important. Now we have to engage in conversations with banks, with financial institutions, to say that they will accept the ID if someone wants to open a bank account. That's really important, that someone could use the ID if they want to sign up for a lease, right? And so this is a way that is really important for the economic vibrancy of New York City as well. And I think that that's something that sometimes is overlooked. If we can make something like this succeed in a city of New York with 8.3 million people as a progressive and inclusive policy, then it can serve as a model for others that would like to consider and implement the same.
The New York Daily News, Madam Speaker, has singled out a contractor hired to get these ID cards rolled out. It's Gartner Incorporated. They have a long history of going way over budget for projects that they do in New York City, like the upgrade of 911 or the Department of Consumer Affairs. So, you know, when a time when everything is being watched to the dollars, how do you, as Speaker, take the role of essentially overseeing that the money spent on the city ID program will be well spent?
So our responsibility, and we played a very active role when the whole City Times scandal was emerging. We had hearings from the Contracts Committee that exposed a lot of what was happening. So we're obviously not interested in repeating that. These are taxpayer dollars. We want to be efficient. This is information that came out recently. I know we're aware of it, and we definitely would like to look into it. We don't want to repeat mistakes. But our interest is definitely to have this municipal ID program rolled out in the most efficient way possible, in the most responsible way. And so we want to, you know, we're stewards of the taxpayers. And we have to make sure that we are being responsible with their funds. So we will be looking into this, and we'll and we have our set of questions also for the administration. That's something that we have a responsibility to follow up on.
Madam Speaker, thank you so much for joining us in our studios here in Harlem.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you. Coming up on Latino USA.
We were ladies in waiting, just waiting for the thing to happen. And when it did happen, we were there.
An overlooked icon of the Stonewall movement. Stay with us. No se vayan.
To bring me down, tie the
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, our show is all about nuestro New York City. Now, let's do some math. Let's say you work in a restaurant and you make only $5.50 an hour. Your shift is 10 hours a day. You're there Saturdays and Sundays, but you don't get any overtime. That comes up to $385 a week. But working more than 8 hours a day without overtime pay is illegal. In a city with 24,000 restaurants like New York, that opens the door to a lot of potential misconduct. Latino USA's Sarah Barrett explains how two workers try to fight wage theft in New York City.
Wage theft can take many forms. There are cases where employers garnish their workers' wages, taking a little off the top. Sometimes employees are told not to clock in until after their shift starts. The most egregious is when employers don't pay their workers minimum wage. Undocumented women are hurt the most.
Mi nombre es Erlinda Carvajal y yo trabajo
Erlinda Carvajal works in a Brooklyn bakery. She is a young mom, originally from Mexico. She lives with her husband and daughter in a small room that she rents in Brooklyn.
Pues ahí entrábamos hasta las 7:30 de la mañana.
Erlinda says she and her co-workers arrived at the bakery at 7:30 every morning. They spent the day mixing and kneading dough, making bread until it got dark out. For 5 years, she worked at the bakery, 12-hour days, 6 days a week, for $400. That's about $5.50 an hour. Her story is more common than you might think. Senior staff attorney at the National Employment Law Project, Sade Gebrselassie.
You know, it's a huge, huge problem. And we estimated that, on average, workers lost about $2,500 a year due to wage theft, which is a large sum in any case, but especially if you're a low-wage worker and you're making like $15,000, $18,000 a year, that's a significant portion of your paycheck.
She adds that it's estimated that employers steal $1 billion from their workers every year in New York City alone. Sade Gebrselassie says undocumented workers are protected by minimum wage laws. But few seem to know that.
Undocumented workers in this country are entitled to be paid the minimum wage, to be paid overtime, to be paid all of the wages that are due to them under federal and state wage and hour laws.
Problem is, the Labor Department can't enforce all the complaints.
Mi nombre es Melania Santana. Yo trabajo en un restaurante.
Melania Santana was a cook in a restaurant in East New York. When she learned she was entitled to overtime, she filed a complaint with the Department of Labor. Melania is an undocumented worker from the Dominican Republic. She worked 7 days a week and made a flat rate of $475.
Yo necesitaba un día libre porque yo tenía que dedicarle tiempo a mi esposo.
She's 57 and says she wanted time to be with her husband. She says she couldn't work 7 days straight anymore. Her body needed a day off. The Department of Labor sided with Melania. It issued an order of compliance to her former employer for $19,000.
Ya han pasado 6 años después de eso. Y el Departamento de Labor ha estado muy lento también con ese caso.
It's been 6 years, Melania says, since she filed the complaint. In that time, the restaurant has changed owners, and Melania hasn't received any of the money she is owed. Janice Fine, a professor of labor studies at Rutgers University, says the Department of Labor doesn't have the money or enough investigators to keep up with the complaints.
Now we've got a culture of non-compliance. The most important thing is that we will never have enough investigators. There's still, you know, one investigator per 100,000 or more workplaces.
In June, the State Comptroller's Office audited the Department of Labor and found that there's a backlog of over 17,000 complaints. It also found that 3/4 of those complaints are more than a year old.
You know, in the old days, I did some interviews with labor standards investigators in New York and in New Jersey, and they told me stories about how they used to go door to door.
James Versace from the New York Restaurant Association says he doesn't think the backlog of cases points to a culture of non-compliance.
I don't think it's a testament to a wage theft problem. I think that's a problem in that they're backed up because they have, I think, a 3 or 4 year backlog on cases in that division.
The audit is very clear. Quote, it is imperative that the DOL do a better job resolving wage theft cases. as workers across New York are often waiting too long for the compensation they rightly deserve. Alfonso David is the Deputy Secretary of Civil Rights in New York. He says the labor standards are being upheld.
The basis for the audit, we thought, was deeply flawed. They looked at selected cases and used those cases as a basis to draw certain conclusions. The process that the agency has used to process wage theft cases over the past few years have been extremely, we would say, effective.
Erlinda, the young woman who works at the bakery, didn't go through the Department of Labor. She and five of her coworkers filed a civil lawsuit against her employer. It's been a year since the legal process started, and things are starting to look better for them.
No, ahora nos paga el sueldo mínimo. Tampoco nos aumentó, pues, pero es el mínimo y trabajamos solo 8 horas.
She says that now her employer pays them the minimum wage, and they work 8-hour days. And if it's more than 8 hours, they get paid overtime. Erlinda's story is a hopeful one. The legal system worked. And now she's an organizer with a community group called Make the Road. That's where she met Melania. They're fighting to improve the lives of the lowest paid workers. When she came to New York, she says she didn't know she had rights, and she didn't know where to go for help.
Como le digo que venimos de así, gente pobre, queremos trabajar acá. Y no, hay veces que no sabemos en dónde nos pueden ayudar.
She says they are just looking for work. And she wants other workers to know that there are places like Make the Road where you can go to ask questions and get help like she did. For Latino USA, I'm Sarah Barrett.
Now to a New York story that changed the entire country. You've probably heard about the Stonewall Rebellion, but who you might not have heard about is someone named Sylvia Rivera. Rumored to have helped start the riot at Stonewall, the Bronx-born Puerto Rican was a tireless advocate for gay and transgender rights throughout her life. Julia Alsop looks at Sylvia Rivera's sometimes slippery place in LGBT history.
Being gay in late 1960s New York City was a risky proposition. Despite the dangers, arrest, harassment, assault, New York City still had a thriving gay scene. Scholar Larry LaFontaine Stokes gives us the lowdown on 1960s queer Latino life.
The 1960s was a period of great effervescence in New York City for Puerto Ricans, for queer Puerto Ricans.
Stokes and other historians of the period believe that Boricuas of the Great Migration of the 40s and 50s injected new life into the city's already established gay scene.
They are predominantly working class. Some of them have been kicked out of their homes and are living on the streets or hanging out in places like Times Square on 42nd Street or in Greenwich Village around Christopher Street, which was an area of lots of gay life and gay bars.
One of these homeless youths was a young Puerto Rican queen named
Sylvia Rivera. My name before that was Ray Rivera until I started dressing in drag in 1961.
Raised in the Bronx by her Venezuelan grandmother, Sylvia left home at age 11. She began dressing in drag and turning tricks on the sidewalks of 42nd Street.
The era before Stonewall was a hard era. There was always the gay bashings on the drag queens. We learned to live with it, but none of us were very happy about it.
Sylvia and her friends called themselves street queens. At the time, there were laws against cross-dressing, and police raids on gay bars were common. By the age of 17, Sylvia had made countless trips to Rikers Island.
The drag queen took a lot of oppression, and we were ladies in waiting, just waiting for the thing to happen. And when it did happen, we were there.
She's referring to the Stonewall Rebellion, also commonly known as the birthplace of the modern gay rights movement. On June 28, 1969, the police raided the Stonewall Inn, a mafia-run gay bar in the heart of Greenwich Village.
They were
I remember someone throwing a Molotov cocktail. I don't know who the person was, but I mean, I saw that and I just said to myself in Spanish, I said, oh my God, the revolution is finally here. And I'm just like started screaming, freedom. We're free at last, you know, and it felt really good.
Common queer folklore has it that Sylvia threw the second Molotov cocktail that night. And that's true, at least according to Sylvia.
You know, Sylvia stated that she was inside the Stonewall Bar when it happened. Other sort of contesting sort of testimony is that she was actually asleep in Washington Square Park, sleeping off heroin or something like that.
Historian Christopher Mitchell says it's a classic case of he said, she said. There are two official accounts of Stonewall. One, published in 1993 by Martin Duberman, which takes Sylvia as a central character. The other came in 2004 by a guy named David Carter. In Carter's version, Sylvia doesn't even make the footnote.
The newspaper articles at the time don't really name any of the participants. In addition to the fact that this is sort of an underground culture that succeeds precisely by not leaving a record.
Eyewitness accounts of the Stonewall Rebellion vary wildly. But over time, something kind of peculiar has happened to the narrative of Stonewall.
Stonewall has, over time, become whiter. It's become more middle class. You know, it almost seems to have been cut and tailored to fit a movement that in some ways is much less radical than the sort of moment that spawned it.
And this whitening of the narrative coincides with the dropping of Sylvia Rivera from historical texts about Stonewall. What makes her narrative so important is that she represents the working-class queer, Black, and Latino street youth who Mitchell says were responsible for the more militant actions that night.
You know, the sort of impetus and the force comes from Sheridan Square and from the homeless people, from the street people who are living in Sheridan Square. You have a huge people of color contingent, especially Puerto Rican Latina participants.
For Larry LaFontaine Stokes, Sylvia's Latina, queer, and trans identities are all intertwined.
For me as a scholar, it has been very important to learn more about Sylvia Rivera, to teach the history or the story of Sylvia Rivera. It is crucial to be able to understand my experience as a gay Puerto Rican man in 2014 and be able to trace this arc.
In 1970, Sylvia and other gay activists organized the first Christopher Street Liberation March to commemorate the Stonewall Rebellion. It's a tradition that would later become known as Gay Pride. And Sylvia said she never missed a march, even after 1973, when she was booed off stage while advocating for transgender rights.
Listen. I've been trying to get up here all day for your gay brothers and your...
Maybe whether or not Sylvia was actually at Stonewall doesn't really matter, because she was definitely present in the movement after. She organized with the Young Lords and the Black Panthers, and she founded an organization called STAR, Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries. She continued to fight for the rights of trans and Latino street youth up until her death in 2002. For Latino USA, I'm Julia Alsop.
And now, a little New York City history. In 1977, a Puerto Rican activist group, the Young Lords, took over the Statue of Liberty, closed it down, and hung a Puerto Rican flag over Lady Liberty's crown. It was a brazen act of grassroots protest in support of Puerto Rican independence. It got the Young Lords national attention, even around the world. But they were already well known in El Barrio of Spanish Harlem for their community activism. They were rebels, but this past July, the city of New York named a street after them. Young Lords Way is in the heart of Spanish Harlem, outside a church the group once occupied. We were there for the official street naming ceremony.
Today, I come here to celebrate the naming of the Young Lords Way street, corner of East 111th Street and Lexington Avenue in what we call El Barrio, New York City. The Young Lords defended a lot of Latino rights in New York and throughout the country. They started in Chicago, Illinois, and spread through the country with different chapters. They created a lot of conscience for people in the struggle and people who were living in poverty, and I was glad to be a sympathizer of that movement. It's very emotional for me, and I got to meet some of the people who were my idols back in those days.
They did all kinds of good social justice, good. They had a garbage offensive where they also piled the streets up on this very avenue right now, Lexington Avenue, to demand that the city of New York pick up garbage because it would stay for days and weeks sometimes in front of tenements, producing rats and all kinds of health concerns. They took over a TB truck at Lincoln Hospital when people weren't being tested for tuberculosis.
It shows how youth can be very meaningful. They were just involved in just about every and anything that had to do with finding equal rights for Puerto Ricans, and not only for Puerto Ricans, for anybody here, making the United States live what they talk.
When we think about a lot of the groups and movements that come out of New York and also countrywide, a lot of the lesser-known groups who did make major impacts in their communities, we don't get to know a lot about. I mean, groups like the Young Lords, they need to be acknowledged, and they need to be celebrated, and they need to be honored.
To me, it means it's a recognition of the work that they did, and a recognition of us as a community. That's why, to me, it's important that it's recognized, even if when before they were kind of vilified. So
today, revolution seems sometimes like a sin and change. The founders of this country were revolutionaries. Had they been alive today and taking the actions they did, they probably would have been labeled as terrorists. But we weren't terrorists. We were activists trying to liberate our communities from oppression.
The amazing thing is that they were all teenagers. The oldest was about 20 years old. And that's what our teenagers now need to know, that they have power, that they can say what goes on in their community, what needs to be. They can hold elected officials to account. And they can shut down everything if it's not happening. And we need to make our children aware that, yes, they stand on the shoulders of these people.
I'm a filmmaker and an archivist, so I like to look at old footage. And just when you see the community spirit that this little Young Lord's office engendered, old lady stopped by, the young men will come and sit on the stoop. It just seemed to be such a center of community activity. And the fact that that activity was underlined by political education, I think was so, so important.
I think that it's a win-win situation for Puerto Ricans in East Harlem. You know, as you know, gentrification is in East Harlem. You walk a few blocks away from here and you don't have too many Latinos. And so this is a symbol of Latinos still being alive in New York City and in East Harlem, of course.
Remember, today is a celebration of community, and let's have fun.
Thank you.
That was Ray Delgado, David Galarza, Lorraine Montenegro, Latasha Diggs, Shalimar Calendario, and Carlos Diaz. And Roxanne Scott produced our story for us. Coming up on Latino USA.
If you had to describe what Fania is in a few sentences, what does Fania mean?
Well, Motown is to R&B, and soul, Fania is to salsa.
A legendary record label is in new hands. Stay with us. No se vayan.
And if you feel like I feel, baby, then come on, come on, oh, come on.
Let's get it on.
Perdóname.
quise lastimarte. Y tú sabes que no puedo olvidarte.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and here's a game you can try. Ask the person closest to you right now the question, where does salsa music come from? Chances are they'll probably say Puerto Rico, Cuba, or Cali, Colombia. Well, they're all wrong. The correct answer is that salsa, as we know it, was born and raised in the barrios of New York City. And the music label that made it all happen was Fania Records. After years of huge hits, Fania crashed and burned in the 1980s. But recently, the label has been resurrected by new owners who have a new vision for its future. But not everybody from the old school is on board. Latino USA's Marlon Bishop has our story.
We're going to show you what we were doing back in 1968.
In 1968, Joe Batan was a kid from East Harlem, recording boogaloo tunes for an upstart Latin music label called Fania Records. Today, Joe is performing in a Staten Island park as part of Fania's 50th anniversary celebrations. A native New Yorker crowd of all shades has turned out. They're sitting back in fold-out chairs, dancing, and soaking up the nostalgia. Tony Lopez puffs on a cigar, looking like he's having the time of his life.
We're big-time Joe Batan fans, big-time, from way back in the day. And I'm telling you, I'm 55 years old. I was a kid when he came out with his music. He was off the hook, man.
The people gathered here aren't just fans of Batan. They're fans of Fania itself. And that's because Fania is no ordinary record label. If you had to describe what Fania is in a few sentences, what does Fania mean?
Well, Motown is to R&B, and soul, Fania is to salsa.
It's everything Latin. The culture, the music, the food.
The greatest Latin music label of all time.
The dance, the people, the language.
It's the personification of salsa.
That's what it means. It's to me.
Fania Records was founded in 1964 by two classic New York dudes. Johnny Pacheco was a Dominican immigrant who led the hottest Latin band in the city. Jerry Masucci was a street-smart lawyer, an ex-cop from Brooklyn. They decided to team up and start a record label that could beat out Alegre Records, the top dog Latin label of the moment. Here's Joe Batan.
They fused this label, and of course, I guess the first artist they recorded was Johnny Pacheco. After that, they followed with Bobby Valentin. And then they branched out and got new talent like Willie Colon, and then finally they got me. The rest was history. They were two dynamic guys, really ahead of their time, and just captured the industry.
But Fania really exploded in the 70s when it became home base for an exciting new musical movement known as salsa.
A whole new world opened up with salsa. Yeah. And all of these artists were brought to different levels that they never thought that they were achieved. They were taken out of their leadership roles in their own particular bands and grouped into the Fania All-Stars, and it became a worldwide name.
We're hearing Celia Cruz at the legendary Fania All-Stars concert of 1973, when 40,000 fans packed Yankee Stadium. Fania recorded just about every great Latin artist of the era. Hector Lavoe, Ray Barreto, Ruben Blades, you name them. The label was grossing $5 million a year and commanding 80% of the market. But it wouldn't last. By 1980, Fania was in serious financial trouble. The label folded due to a perfect storm of changing music tastes, bad business decisions, and interpersonal problems. For years, the catalog essentially gathered dust. Until recently, that is.
My name's Michael Rucker, and I'm the chief marketing officer for Codigo Group. We currently own the Fania catalog and brand.
In 2009, Fania's assets were bought by an investment firm called Signal Equity Partners, operating under the name Código Group. According to their website, Signal Equity specializes in leveraged buyouts, roll-ups, and restructurings. It was an unlikely match. Before Fania, they were busy buying up telephone exchanges. But Michael Rucker convinced the investors that there was money to be made in classic Latin music.
There's this huge opportunity to go out and look at Latin catalogs and to roll them up and to archive and to treat them right and to treat them with respect and then to collect on that respect.
The company bought not only Fania, but 14 other Latin catalogs from the same era, including West Side Latino and Cubanay Records.
Now today, we have almost 3,000 albums by 200 artists. Spanning almost 50 years of tropical music.
Taken together, it's an enormous chunk of Latin music history. They fished the master tapes out of old storage units and got the records up on digital services like Spotify and iTunes. They also pressed up new best of albums and began selling t-shirts bearing art from classic Fania album covers.
And that's really what we're doing from a business standpoint, and so far it's worked really well for us.
Meanwhile in the Bronx, things haven't been working very well for Mike Amadeo, owner of the famed Casa Amadeo Salsa record shop.
¿Cómo estás? Marlon.
Mike Amadeo.
The store has been in continuous operation since 1941, but it might not last much longer.
Business is lousy. Nobody in the music business is going to tell me after 64 years that this is going to be like it was before. It will never happen again.
Amadeo says that in Fania's heyday, records flew off the shelves. He made $7,000 a week, more than three times what he takes in today. He says there used to be 100 ballrooms with live bands in the Bronx alone. Today, not one is left. And if you ask him about the new Fania owners, let's just say he's not pleased.
Let him buy an American record company, you know, for the English-speaking people where they know what the hell they're doing.
Amadeo was once a shot caller in the salsa industry, back when everyone involved were friends and extended family from the barrio. He and other old-timers say they feel neglected by the new Fania. Amadeo, for example, says the new owners never once called him up to try to learn from his decades of experience selling music to the community.
What Fania is doing right now is killing the industry. The few people that go to the stores to buy records, they want the original recordings as they came out.
The thing is, the new Fania isn't particularly interested in reaching the people that go to the stores to buy records. For Michael Rucker, there's a different audience in mind.
How do we take this to a younger audience today? Because at the end of the day, if you're not reinventing, if you're not going to and finding new listeners, then ultimately you die. And that's exactly what we don't want to happen.
In an attempt to reach younger audiences, Fania has been working with DJs and putting out remix albums that sample their catalog. For some members of the salsa community, like Mike Amadeo, this is sacrilege. But Joe Batan, for one, isn't so sure.
If you sit on history, it dies, right? So you gotta lift yourself from your seat, let history breathe, and then pass it on. And then you have a chance with your music.
It's unclear whether the new Fania will succeed in reaching the youth. The label won't share sales numbers, so we don't know how well they're actually doing. But at least they're trying, says Batan, and giving the next generation a chance to decide what Fania means to them. For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop.
If you've been listening, you might have noticed that I took a little bit of time off recently. And my staff, traitors, decided to go on the search for the best tacos in New York City while I was gone. What? That's the search that I've been on for 35 years since I first arrived in New York from Chicago. And there were like three Mexicans in New York at the time. But New York's going through an intra-Latino cultural shift. And that means, one, more Mexicans, and two, better Mexican food. Antonia Cerejido and Michael Simon Johnson hit the streets of the city in search of el mejor taco.
Conventional wisdom says that you can't find good Mexican food in New York City.
After all, this is the city of Puerto Ricans and Dominicans.
I love Dominican food.
But Mexican arrivals are just starting to make their mark. So just to be clear, we're not talking about your fancy upscale trendy taqueria, but the kind of place where you can sit down and get a reasonably priced and delicious meal.
So we made a game plan.
We tweeted out to you folks about where we should go and got an overwhelming response that led us to focus on three neighborhoods.
Corona in Queens, Loisaida, or the East Village in Manhattan, and Sunset Park in Brooklyn.
So we hopped on the 7 train and thus began our talkumentary.
Corona!
Corona is in the heart of Queens.
And we're here in Queens, and it smells delicious right off the subway. Corona was easily the most recommended neighborhood by people who got back to us on social media.
Have you seen more kids and babies in this neighborhood
than I have in the last month?
Yeah. And look, they're playing soccer.
We heard no English while we were there.
We walked west on Roosevelt Avenue to a restaurant called Dulcingo.
The strangest thing about this restaurant is that there is a deer head on the wall.
So apparently that deer head has been here since this restaurant's opening. So it's been here for 20 years. And they immediately brought us chips, so word.
Any possible Mexican item you ever wanted is on this menu.
These are like tacos on steroids, though. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, this is not... It's still delicious, and if anything, I think this place is, like, more comforting, like...
Leaving Queens, we heard about another place, Zaragoza, tucked away in the densely packed East Village on Avenue A.
Loisaida!
During the 80s and 90s, Loisaida, a catch-all name for the East Village and the neighboring Lower East Side, was well over half Hispanic, mostly Puerto Rican. It was only in the 2010 census that the Hispanic population of the neighborhood dipped below half for the first time since 1980.
Thank you.
Okay, so you can find good Puerto Rican food in this part of town, but Zaragoza is a tiny Mexican food haven. One of the cool things about this place is that it's really a small grocery store, stacked with productos mexicanos. Hot sauces, beans, Mexican sodas, all kinds of things that would make a Mexican transplant feel at home.
I just thought it was cool that they sold goat tacos.
I've never had a goat taco.
I can sense, like, this is a place where people come to, like, get the things that they miss from home, and this place is, like, it's homey. It has a really tiny taco building station, and it's just a one-man situation.
That one man is Martinez.
Pompeo.
Yeah, that's start of 14 years.
14 years?
Mm-hmm.
Have you been here all 14 years?
Mm-hmm.
Sí?
Yeah.
Where are you from?
I come from Mexico.
Where in Mexico?
I come from Puebla.
Puebla.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
It seems like most Mexicans in New York come from Puebla.
Just when we thought we Mexicans couldn't eat any more tacos, we ventured to our final neighborhood, Sunset Park in Brooklyn.
Sunset Park!
Like most of Brooklyn, Sunset Park has hosted many different immigrant groups over the years, like Irish and Scandinavian immigrants. Recently, it's become a wide mix of different Hispanic groups. In many ways, it's Brooklyn's Mexican hub. But the diversity is still apparent.
We headed over to our first and only food truck.
No, but look at the door. That's a taco bus.
But before we could even eat our food, we had overheard a conversation the owner, Mariano Tapia, was having with the city health inspector.
Just to be clear, this place is totally up to code. They were talking about how someone was complaining about the loud noise made by the generator used to power the truck.
Bus,
right.
Yeah, but it's, you know why? Because we have customers, so... Sometimes busy, you know, so I think the restaurants complain about us, you know. I think it's the restaurants.
Like, because you'd be taking business away from them?
Yeah, that's what I think.
Mariano told me something interesting. He said that he's noticed lots of new Mexican restaurants opening up, but they're not necessarily owned or run by Mexicans. People have been saying that there's more Mexican food in New York, but what they really mean is there's more of a Mexican presence. American culture has become much more interested in Mexican cuisine.
And we've noticed that too, which is why we're here.
So we got
chorizo
and
pastor.
These tacos were Mexico City style, meaning they're tiny, but they come with an entire cooked white onion on top. It was crazy, but it did make it unique.
It's like fresco, it's like fresh with the onion. It's nice. I was born in New York City, and I lived here till I was 11. And then when we moved to San Diego, I was like 11 years old. We were in San Diego, we were in the car, and I told my parents that I wanted to get Chinese food. And we drove around, like, these big malls for, like, 30 minutes, and we couldn't find a Chinese restaurant. And that was it for me. Like, I just started bawling. Like, I was so upset about this move, and I was like, what kind of city doesn't have a Chinese restaurant? And it's funny now because I had that experience with Mexican food, and moving here back, it's like, how is there not a great taco place in every freaking corner?
But maybe we'll see New York change over the next few decades, and maybe in 20 years there will be a good taco place on every corner. For Latino USA, I'm Michael Simon Johnson.
And I'm Antonia Cerejida.
So, where are your favorite tacos in New York? Tell us at LatinoUSA on Twitter, or better yet, tell me at Maria_Hinojosa on Twitter. We started off our program today by hearing from New York City Council Speaker Melissa Mark Viverito, the most powerful Latina politician in New York. But she started off as a community activist and then was an organizer for the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union. It's been a struggle, as it is with any achievement, to get to where she is. A three-term city council member, the speaker for the council, and a transplant from Puerto Rico. So, we turn back to her for our weekly words of wisdom, or sabiduría.
I've had a blessing to really meet some incredible women that have continued to inspire me, even though some of them are not with us today. One of the people that I believe really inspires me every day is Dr. Antonia Pantoja, who was one of the major stewards in the Puerto Rican community who I had the fortune to meet and to be inspired by. And so it's really about finding people that are going to push you. And they're going to challenge you. We live in a society where our young people still to this day, despite we have made progress, we still have a lot of progress to do, that continuously wants to tell us that we're less than and that we can't accomplish. And my challenge to young people is that you need to push beyond that. There's always going to be people that are going to tell you that you cannot do it. But you need to move forward and find those people that are going to challenge you to take the next step. And every day, you got to look to grow a little bit, to challenge yourself. Whatever's uncomfortable, push beyond that. Sticking to your comfort zone is not going to have you grow. And that's something that I've continually pushed by. When somebody tells me I can't, I say I'm going to figure it out.
Melissa Mark Viverito is the speaker for the New York City Council. And that's it for this week. Latino USA was produced by AC Valdez, Katie Davis, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Julia Alsop, Sarah Barrett, and Roxanne Scott. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. And a special shout out to WNYC's Sara Gonzalez and our own Daisy Rosario for filling in for me recently so I could reconnect with my familia. Gracias. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. And you can check out my Instagram at Maria_La_Hinojosa. I'll see you there.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. And the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
There's like beans underneath the meat. Look at that. You see that?
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like we split open a geode.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Annie E. Casey Foundation, with 25 years of Kids Count data on the well-being of America's children at datacenter.kidscount.org. And Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. This is NPR.